The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly for the end of February 2008, a year I thought was so far in the future that we'd already be in flying cars and eating Soylent Green. Sadly, technology's not advanced as quickly as the 1950s science fiction writers predicted, but we're still here, chewing over the silicon and following in the baby steps towards a robotic-controlled future. Joining me in the proverbial feast are regular diners Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish, and new recruit Guardian technology guru Vic Keegan. Welcome to you all. Now, rumor has it, Vic, that you are the longest-standing employee of The Guardian. Is this true?
I'm the longest-sitting employee right now. Yes, it is. No one else would dare to claim it. It's too embarrassing.
Can we say 43 years?
It was a few years ago, yeah.
On this week's episode, we're getting political, dissecting the fallout from the government's threatened anti-file-sharing legislation with the help of the British phonographic industry and the ISP Association. And Vic leads us through the implications of the government's sluggish broadband rollout. New startup AdJug enters the lift this week in the elevator pitch, and we tackle the difficult decisions made by internet companies Facebook, YouTube, and eBay in the news. Plus, blogs, feedback, and entertaining conversations. Stay tuned to Tech Weekly. First up, content companies have proposed a three strikes and you're out policy for file sharers. The story made the front page of last Thursday's technology section. The first whiff of this news broke 2 weeks ago and is the subject of a joint initiative from the Department for Culture, Media and Sport and the Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform. The report was published last Friday, and Charles, you wrote the article, and you've been digging around in the camps of the stakeholders, the music industry and the internet service providers, for details of how this would play out in reality. So what's the story here?
Well, the government said that if the ISPs and the music industry can't agree by April of 2009 on how they'll stamp down file sharing, then it will legislate. And everyone is pretty much agreed that legislation would be bad news. So to find out more about what the two sides really think about the voluntary system they're trying to implement, I spoke to Nick Landsman, who's the Director General of the ISP Association, ISPA. But first, I spoke to Matt Phillips, who's a spokesman for the BPI, and I asked him whether he was satisfied with the strategy paper the government had put out.
I think so, and it's a very wide-reaching document. It's not missed anyone's attention that for some time now we've been trying, in particular, to negotiate voluntary solutions with ISPs over potential disconnections of repeat offenders in terms of illegal downloading. And the government has stepped up their rhetoric, certainly on this. And what's very encouraging is that they've mapped out a very clear time frame by which voluntary agreements need to be sought.
There's a lot of detail still to be worked out, though, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, simply what the BPI has been trying to achieve with internet service providers is for them to put in place procedures whereby people whom we have identified as file sharing illegally are first of all sent a letter to let them know that their account is being abused before eventually taking a sort of temporary suspension on that account and then eventually terminating that account should the first two letters be ignored.
Who actually bears the shares of the costs involved in this? Because to the ISPs, there must be some costs involved in sending out the legal letters.
Well, certainly what seems as a reasonable division of labour to us is that we will do the policing and they ultimately have to hit the button to send the letter.
Nick Landsman, is ISPA satisfied with the government strategy document that came out last week?
I think the government seemed to make it very clear within their paper that they prefer a form of voluntary agreement rather than going down a legislative route. And that's probably for many reasons. Legislation is a pretty blunt instrument. Really, what we're looking at here is trying to work out a way of dealing with infringing copyright that's workable, that's sort of legal and is economically sustainable.
Speaking to the BPI, their sort of suggestion, the implication I'm getting from that is that it's pretty much all sorted out, that you have a three strikes and you're out, that they'll do the policing, as they call it. They'll pass you on the details and then it's just down to the ISPs to send out a letter and tell people they've been naughty.
Well, I think partially that may seem on the face of what's going to happen. I think the minister, Andy Burnham, ruled out the three strikes and you're out rule because it was simply not always appropriate. And there's circumstances where, for example, if a family has a Wi-Fi connection for their internet, it's not clear really who might be doing the infringing if there's some teenagers in the household. And to immediately cut people off from the internet sometimes also where people are using the internet for their main telephone connection as well, it might be a bit harsh. And so we're looking at ways in which we can indeed pass on notices without passing over users' personal data.
You seem to be suggesting then that it might not be three strikes, it might be four or five or six or...
Well, the detail is yet to be worked out.
If you move forward with however many strikes policy, is it clear where the legal responsibility will lie? If the BPI, for example, is, or the MPAA is sending you the details about infringing IP addresses and you send a letter onto someone, if that person who receives the letter complains and says, nothing to do with me, I'm going to sue you now, who's going to have the legal responsibility? Who's going to be the person standing up in court? Will it be the ISP or will it be the MPAA or who?
Right, well, you've hit the nail on the head. In fact, you've raised a number of issues that show how difficult to come up with a form of wording that's acceptable to all, and we're in the process of doing that. One of the things that the internet industry has been asking for, this business has been asking for, is some form of indemnification, so that if, despite the good evidence that's given by rights holders, we take that evidence in good faith and act on it, then the indemnification would be to pay costs if there's an error involved in the process.
Would people who are accused necessarily have to go to court to complain if they thought they were being wrongly accused? Or would there be some sort of forum where they could complain?
Well, I think the whole purpose of this scheme, a voluntary scheme, is to avoid really the cost for the rights holders of going to court and indeed the cost for ISPs. They can certainly come back to the ISP, who is going to be sending out the notice or passing on the notice from the rights holder. What the ISP does not want to have to do is he's act as judge and jury on this. If that notice is disputed by the end user, then the end user can come back also directly to the rights holder and say, you've made a mistake, this is not me.
Matt, will other organisations outside the UK be able to use this? I mean, if an American record company thinks it's found evidence of a British user doing file sharing, will they be able to get a letter sent via the ISP?
I think in the first instance, this would be mainly a UK deal. So this would be specific to UK ISPs and UK consumers. And certainly we've seen a similar process being put into operation in France. Again, it's early days in France. And it, certainly partnering with ISPs from our point of view makes the most sense.
Here's the key question. Do you think that once this system is put in place and is running smoothly, do you think that you'll see an increase in sales of your products?
It's not a question of me having a document in front of me that says, you know, if we can get ISPs to cooperate, sales will go up by 52.1% or something like that. What I think the most significant difference it will make is that it will send a very clear message that copyright is something that can be respected on the internet, and the creative industries can begin to thrive.
One argument that people on our blogs have been making is that this is simply market pressures. The reason why people are preferring to go with file sharing rather than buying the legitimate product is that they prefer the price, and that the price of products online is still far too high for their liking. That that without the distribution costs, the value chain costs, such as having to put them into stores, that the price of an album should be more like $2.99 rather than $79.99.
I do appreciate and I understand that argument, but I think at the same time that many people don't understand the creative processes and the business models around those creative processes that return money to the creators and investors. You know, the Guardian online is available for me for free as a consumer, but you know, it doesn't mean that it's created for free just because it's online. There is a need to generate money to pay the creative people in that process. Ultimately, everything relative to free and freely available is going to be impossible to compete with on the sole basis of price.
But it's not freely available, is it? If you moved into the market and had something that was really good, if all the albums on iTunes cost, you know, £3 rather than £8, they'd be much happier about buying them because the incremental cost is so much less.
If every album on iTunes is available for 50p, that would be very attractive, but that doesn't necessarily make for a commercial model that can encourage future investment in music and pay all the people involved in the creation and investment in that product. So while I can understand that consumers would want everything for free, that clearly isn't a commercial proposition.
That was Matt Phillips from the BPI and Nick Lansman from ISPA. Now, Charles, it seems to me that there are some pretty big gaping holes in what ISPA and what the BPI are talking about in terms of the process. What actually is the process proposed?
The one that's being proposed by the BPI is that they will, as they have been doing for some time, monitor internet connections in the UK. Any file sharing software will show you who else is connected to do that file sharing. And IPs that they find are doing a lot of file sharing, they will pass on the details about that IP, when they monitored it and what it was doing. They'll pass that on to the ISP that owns it. This doesn't mean they know who is doing it. And the ISP, which will be able to find out who's doing it, but won't know particularly what was being done, will then send a warning letter to the person saying, hey, we think your account's being used for a lot of file sharing, please desist. If this happens twice over, if you get three warning letters from the ISP, you'd be cut off. What I think came out of the conversations there's a lot of uncertainty. Who do you have recourse to? Who's responsible? There's a big gap between the two.
One of the first things that I thought about when this news first broke a couple of weeks ago is, gosh, this is going to be a fantastic new industry for new BitTorrent sites and various other encryption people, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the internet. You know, as soon as there's a problem, they root round it. And they're always going to be one step ahead. So until the industry tries to explore and embrace these technologies and actually use them and maybe rethink rights, which are at the root of all this, it's going to be an ongoing problem.
I'm not sure if it's right so much that is the problem as just price. People latched onto the first Napster because, A, it was free, which, you know, is a hard price to beat. But, B, there was this enormous... It was the jukebox in the sky. Even in the days of dial-up, you could find any old thing that you wanted to find.
Yeah, I agree with that about price, and the industry really hasn't caught up with this. If somebody downloads 2,000 files... What are they going to do, listen to them sequentially or just shuffle? If they shuffle, it's just like listening to the radio. And they could go to Last FM and get a thing free. They could spend the whole day on iTunes just getting samples of tunes all day long. And there are 7 million bands on MySpace alone, with a lot of them giving away their music free. Small wonder that people are buying fewer tracks. I'm amazed they're buying so many. And if they brought the price down, they'll certainly get an avalanche of people coming, as iTunes has already proved.
Jemima, how different do you think that the perspective of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Associations, are going to take this?
They're even more backward than the music industry. I mean, Hollywood is just so far behind, it's crazy. Did you notice on Torrent Freak today, they had a nice tag cloud showing all of the big Hollywood hits that were Oscar hits that people have been going straight onto BitTorrent and downloading. If that isn't an endorsement of that as a great distribution method, I don't know what is.
Well, thank you very much for that, Charles, and everybody else. I expect we're going to be hearing a lot more about that over the coming months as things start to get a little bit clearer. But now it's time for the news.
An attempt by Pakistan to block YouTube has been blamed for an almost global blackout of the site for 2 hours on Sunday. Pakistan's authorities ordered ISPs to block the site because of content it said was offensive to Islam, but inadvertently led to the site's IP address being hijacked. Facebook saw its first fall in UK users with a 5% drop between December and January, according to Nielsen Online. The metrics firm estimates that Facebook had 8.5 million unique visitors last month, but the site contested the figures and insisted its active user number is still rising. eBay users are unhappy with changes to the auction site announced by incoming chief exec John Donahoe. Power users will get some benefits, but sellers can no longer give negative feedback to buyers. In a survey, 98.7% of users think the changes will have a negative effect on their businesses. And another one bites the HD DVD dust. Microsoft will no longer make the HD DVD add-on for the Xbox 360, although it will still offer warranty support for the 300,000 it has sold.
So, Jemima, do you think we're falling out of love with Facebook?
Oh, well, that's the question, isn't it? Well, there may be some question of seasonality here. Yes, it was January, and if you look at the news websites, they had phenomenal traffic. The Guardian had its highest ever number of unique users at 19.7 million. But social networking is a thing that maybe people take slightly longer to get back into. So if you wanted to err on the side of caution, you could say it's not quite a slump yet. But there are issues with applications like Funwall and Superwall, which have been spamming people. There's concerns about privacy. And there is a sense that there's kind of a fatigue of social networking sites. So
is this
the jury's still out.
Is this a global trend or is this just in the UK, do you know?
These are just UK figures. We know that MySpace's growth has been slowing for some time, according to its ComScore stats. But the wider trend, obviously, is social networking sites becoming more niche. And so we'd expect this field to diversify.
Vic, as a social networker yourself, your list is, friends list is phenomenal. But what do you see coming up? Because certainly, as we saw the decline of Second Life in the papers before Facebook was on the rise, we saw Facebook coming up. Do you see anything that's coming up as Facebook appears to be declining?
Well, I don't think Facebook really is. I think if you seasonally adjusted the figures like you do the unemployment figures, you'd find there'd been a rise last year. But there is a bit of fatigue going on because it's just too congested. I find I'm using it a bit less. But as for the future, people don't want to use their social networks at work and then at home. They want to have it all the time. And so it's going to go mobile. The question is when. In the near future, we've got the possibility of ubiquitous Wi-Fi. The iPhone is already terrific. If that's a bit bigger, you can do all your social networking, even your virtual worlds, on the top of a 38 bus. No, they haven't. It's a 19 bus. The 38 bus is single. Sorry.
A London human there for you.
I made that mistake once before. I got lots of letters. So I think that's where it's going to go. The question is, will Facebook dominate mobile or Google, or will it be a startup? And there are already some of them going on. There's one called Quite Kike, I think it's called. And they all think they're going to grab this territory because they're starting from mobile.
Charles, just briefly.
Quike, it sounds like a bad hand to describe this. I think, you know, once you start to go down, you never come back. I was looking at the stats for Friends Reunited last week, which has fallen by 90% since 2000.
ITV ruined it.
Well, yeah, ITV's reverse Midas touch, isn't it? It's like Microsoft.
Well, actually, commercially, it's still very successful. But
So, moving quickly on to YouTube in Pakistan. This isn't the first time we've heard about a country trying to shut YouTube down for its offensive content. I mean, we've heard about that with China. We've heard about it with various other countries. Mm. But taking the whole site down altogether is...
It's really complicated and quite hard to explain. But it's that the Pakistan government told the Pakistan Telecommunication Authority to block YouTube. It's very easy. You look up a few IP addresses that YouTube has. Pakistan Telecommunications Authority put these into its router, but what it hadn't figured out was that its router would then tell the rest of the world, I know where YouTube lives, and you get to it through me. And this then propagated through the internet. So it had said to the whole world, I know where YouTube is, but you can't go there. And this propagated around the world, and for about a couple of hours, YouTube was out until YouTube, the YouTube engineers, possibly slightly annoyedly, rang the PTA up and said, do you guys realise that you're blocking YouTube for the entire world? And people can't watch a three-year-old girl explain Star Wars.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall. Oh, hi, we're calling from Mountain View. You seem to have taken our entire site down.
Who sues here? You better ask the British Phonographic Association for some advice.
Well, you can read all about these and more tech stories all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. This week, we welcome in our special guest, Vic Keegan, whose history with The Guardian spans several decades, as we discovered in our first item. Vic, apart from your witty commentary, we brought you into the studio because you've got a special subject that you think deserves more attention. Please, step up to the mic and tell us what it is.
Well, I have to confess at the beginning, it's not a new thing. We've been banging on it for 25 years on The Guardian, which is fibre to the home, super broadband to the home. Can you believe it that 25 years ago, this was an argument before the internet and before all of that, for the World Wide Web. Then the argument was, BT offers to do it if they can deliver entertainment and video. Government said, no, that's a monopoly, we won't do it. Why didn't it happen earlier? Well, the engineers were just brilliant in squeezing all these things out of this 50-year-old copper wire, so we can now put television and internet all down simultaneously. But nevertheless, it won't go away. And to my best of my knowledge, there's one home in this country that's got fibre to the home at the moment. It's down in the West Country, I believe, which is hooked up. I've never been able to find them. That was a special occasion.
One person with a cold.
Please, if you're listening, call in. Where are we now? Just as we were then, people say there's no demand for it. Even 6 years ago, Gordon Brown, now Prime Minister, couldn't see what demand there would be for low-speed broadband. And now you only have to look at the way that technology is advancing at a breathtaking pace to realise that in a few years' time, 100 megabits a second is going to be too slow. All the things on the horizon, you've got medicine to the home, all the file sharing, you've got virtual worlds are going to grow hugely and need a lot of capacity, high-definition television. But people won't start designing things for 100 megabits unless it's there, otherwise it's a waste of money. So it's one of those things to me is a no-brainer. You've just got to go and do it. And to be fair, the government, I think, thinks it ought to do this, but it's got a love affair with market forces, and especially after Northern Rock, it wants to leave it to market forces, but market forces won't do it because BT says, look, we can do provide everything down the present wires. We don't need it.
Well, but only 50% or something like that of British people have internet at all anyway. So why is this relevant to the entirety of the UK?
Yeah, no, for the rest, I mean, 50% have broadband, 70% have internet access, and the 30% that don't have internet access have suffer from a digital divide, which is very serious because increasingly you have all knowledge is at your disposal through search engine and all the rest. And if you've got 30% of the population don't have access to that, it's going to affect them right throughout their careers. And that will increasingly happen with broadband. If in a few years' time, 70% of the population's got medicine at home, but 30% hasn't, it's going to be a really, really serious problem. So for that reason as well, I think they ought to go stream ahead with it.
I just can't quite see how one squares the circle of making it pay back. I mean, I can see the point that if you build stuff too early, if you build 100 megabit per second site, but everyone's only working on 8, maximum, then yes, it's not going to work. It's rather like boo.com back in the days of the first dot-com boom. It was a great site. Perhaps if we saw it now, we go, hey, this is all right. But back in the dial-up days, it was death.
I agree with that, but I think there is certainly a contrast between what is in the commercial interests and what is perceived to be in the national interest. But we have to look at abroad, and those countries who are way advanced in broadband, like Japan and South Korea, there's a subtle, in some cases not so subtle, government influence. Now, South Korea's already got nearly there for 100 megabits. They've got over 50. There's a lot of which that have industries that are booming that haven't come here yet. Now, it's not because they're Asian. It's because they've got super-fast broadband. And so in a post-industrial area, with China taking over not only manufacturing now, but increasingly internet services they want to take over, we've got to find new things to do. And if we have got 100 megabit broadband, we might as well, pack up.
Isn't the thing about Japan, particularly in South Korea, that they're very, very urban? If you go out to a more rural part of Japan, then you're going to find nothing at all in terms of...
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So that fibre to the home is easier when you've got big built-up conurbations, and Japan admits it's got a very serious rural problem. In fact, they launched a satellite yesterday in order to bring fast broadband to rural areas. Mm. I'm not sure that there's any plans for that in this country.
Jemima? Having a super fat pipe going into your house is just absolutely essential to the user experience that you have of all this amazing content that's out there. And if we're going to support the music industry and the film industry and the TV industry in supplying amazing content that really works, that isn't glitchy, then the investment just has to be there. It has to be put in. There could be all sorts of businesses out there that are reliant on super fast connections that haven't yet evolved because they can't, because the infrastructure isn't there.
But the other side of it is not only a super fat pipe coming into the house, but you need a big one going out. If you're going to do medicine, then actually it needs to be two-way. You have to be, the doctor has to be able to see how you react as well as you seeing what the doctor is asking you. So you need the synchronous. I mean, as Vic said, fibre to the home, that can be very fast. Though I think with Virgin, there's an issue. Virgin, because it's making all these big plays in its adverts about having, we've got fibre optic, we don't have to worry about, copper cable, that you get a lot of contention when you get a lot of people on who are signed up to Virgin at the same time.
I'm on Virgin, and actually, if you've got the telly on and you're online, which I do all the time, the TV is glitchy and the web isn't that fast.
And it isn't fibre to the home. I was fooled by that. There have been complaints to the Advertising Standards Authority. It's not fibre to the home, it's fibre to the curb. That's maybe why you're getting that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the economic implications, Vic, for what happens to the UK if we don't get fibre to the home?
As far as you can predict the future, it's going to be everything getting very much faster. And the government always has a major role in strategy. Look at, for instance, GSM. That was a result of governments getting together and agreeing a standard. And they could do things with legislation here, just as they opened up the local loop by forcing BT to open it. There's a similar issue with fibre and BT. There are ways of getting it around that don't necessarily involve money. But I do think it's a very serious problem. I'm really glad that the government seems to want to be nudging Ofcom and others to do something about it. Ofcom itself is very much aware of the problem. Ofcom is on record for an independent regulator to say, we must have fast broadband quicker, but it can't find out quite how to do it, and it's got a strange remit because it's got to rely on market forces except where there's an intervention is necessary, and that's just one of those situations now.
Anyway, thank you very much for sharing your burning passion with us this week, Vic, and I'm sure we're going to hear from you again.
Thank you.
But now let's head into the lift with Jemima for this week's elevator pitch.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Which floor would you like?
Would you mind me taking to the marketplace, please?
Going up.
So, who are you and what's your company?
My name is Michael Stefan Blome and I'm from a company called Edjak.
Okay, then. Explain your business to my mum in two sentences.
I think the best way to explain it is Edjak is a marketplace for online advertising where sort of advertisers and publishers can buy and sell directly from each other. It's basically sort of the one-stop shop for the small and medium publisher who doesn't have its own sales force and who wants to sell more advertising to advertisers and agencies online.
First floor.
And tell me about your background.
I used to run a company called Gumtree, and before I was a marketing director at eBay, and I was pretty much involved in sort of many online businesses over the last sort of 10 years.
So how do you make money?
We take a commission, or you can call it a brokerage fee, every time an advertiser, you know, places an ad on the website of a particular publisher.
Second floor.
How many users do you have now, and what's your target within 12 months?
So being a sort of B2B marketplace, we have a couple of thousand users. But if I think about our target, we like to think more in terms of ad impressions. So a couple of billion ad impressions a month within the next 12 months would be pretty nice.
Third floor.
And if you had £10 million to invest in any company other than your own, what would you invest in?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but I think I would probably put it into a business called Wonga. It supplies you with sort of short-term credits if you're short on money. And with the next recession maybe around the corner, I think that's going to be pretty popular.
Fourth floor.
So, are you the next big thing?
If you are a publisher who wants to make more money with a website, or if you are an advertiser who wants to run an efficient online campaign, yes, we are.
What's the weirdest business experience you've had so far?
When I was at eBay, because eBay has such a big global community, people used to come to our office and actually wanted to discuss specific trading experience that they had with us, thinking that we would know what the specific problem was out of millions of transactions.
Fifth floor. Doors opening.
Where have you taken me?
That was awesome. Thanks very much to Michael Stefan Blome from Edjak. So, Jemima, tell me a little bit more about what this is really trying to do.
Yeah, one day I'm going to have to play all of these to my mum to see if she does actually understand them. So it's just quite reassuring to know that there is actually somebody else in the online advertising space other than Google, or that hasn't been bought by Google as well. Google made £1.3 billion in the UK alone last year from online advertising. So it's just great to see somebody else moving into that market. And there's massive opportunity here. And also it's crucial to media sites and to, you know, small independent companies who have to make money, which is still the critical area for all of the startups we're seeing.
So is this going to be the end of Google optimizing and AdWords and things like that?
I think we can safely say not, no. But but there needs to be as much activity in that market as possible. Although I did note he said they'd like to measure themselves in ad impressions, and I think there is a shift in the market to, or at least a shift in understanding that sites need to start thinking about engagement with users in a richer way, which might be time, for example. So the amount of time people spend on a site and therefore with the brands that are on that site and not just the number of clicks, which doesn't give that much information.
Sticky clickiness.
So if you've got a startup and you'd like to be grilled, then send your pitches to Jemima at jemima.kish@guardian.co.uk. So what's been going on the blogs this week? Well, I'm going to start, pole position. On the games blog, we geared up for the Game Developers Conference, or we were geared up, actually, because it's finished. It happened in San Francisco last week, and a big thrust there was the independent games movement. I wrote something about how all of the console holders, Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony, chose this event to announce platforms for independent developers to distribute their wares on, which, personally, I think is great because it's really opening it up. Ginger Yellow, and I think actually his full name is Ginger Yellow 01, thinks that we need to be cautious about how excited we get about this. The key thing for me, he says, is how serious Microsoft are about the peer review part of XNA. So a bit of background, people are able to upload and distribute their independent games that they create that have absolutely no sort of process that goes through the publisher. However, Microsoft have a peer review part. If they're really thinking along the lines of YouTube, then great. But given their control freakery over UT3, which is Unreal Tournament, mods and the like, I'm very skeptical. I strongly suspect that there will be some kind of certification process, albeit more streamlined, between developers and users. The fact that they say full games will be arriving, quote, at the end of 2008, when they had 400 entrants to their competition last year, makes me think I'm right. And actually, what I'd like to say about this is that it is strange that a new medium like games, which is so closely observed by the TV and movie industries for its openness and its content and its innovation, are in fact as cautious as television and movies when it comes to their platforms, which suggests to me that in the independent games revolution, when it happens, will happen on the internet as opposed to on these consoles. Jemima?
Yet more on Facebook. My colleague Mark Sweeney on the media desk wrote a post entitled, "Is Going Niche the Future for Social Networking?" Loads of comments about this. Obviously, everyone has something to say about Facebook. So the poet's thumb said, "It brings the modern elevation of trivia to intolerable heights, so will probably prevail in the end," or at least some version of it, which was quite entertaining. Thomas Lyon made the good point that if the Facebook bubble has burst, I can think of two reasons. Firstly, the endless stupid applications, and secondly, the blocking of Facebook by employers, which is related to the issue of niche services as well, because you could imagine something like LinkedIn. Thank you, Charles. Something like LinkedIn would be supported in a work environment. And then MByte, who I happen to know is the lovely Mike Butcher.
Hello,
from TechCrunch UK, said there's a slight contradiction in that argument that it's losing pace because the major SOCnets are creating local language versions. So by definition, they're already going niche themselves, no?
Charles, what happened on the tech blog?
Well, I blogged about the worries among ISPs over the whole issue of this three strikes and you're out and the fact the uncertainty and who's going to bear the legal costs and so on. And Steve Farr commented, "I was at Leighton Retail Park today," this would have been Saturday, "there were 30 or more Chinese immigrants all flogging DVDs illegally outside the entrances of every store. The place was swarming with security. A few yards away, a police minibus was parked up with police taking a nap inside. At no point during the day were any of these sellers challenged. Here's a thought. How about issuing fines to police for failing to enforce the law against serious crime going on right in front of them? After all, isn't that what the government's proposing to do with ISPs? And here's another one. By actually promoting free downloading, we could put these illegal sellers out of business and prevent the proceeds going to serious organised crime." Got to say, it's got a sort of ring of logic to it.
Ooh, well, that reminds me, I have a pet theory that you should actually find the companies whose litter ends up being on the street, which would then...
Chewing gum manufacturers.
Exactly.
And they already do that with shopping trolleys, don't they?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe that's why you've... See, there you go. It works. You get the shopping trolleys that can't go anywhere else, do you? Stops it. It nips it in the bud, doesn't it?
Yeah, you never see a shopping basket in a river, do you?
Not since Moses.
What have you found on the blogs this week?
Well, it's one from the technology at Guardian's technology blog from Simon H. The blog was complaining about this report that came out. That they say they're giving us 8 megabits broadband
a second.
Up to 8 megabits. But in fact, it's under 3 on average. And this is from Simon H. in Dubai, who says that his internet proxy service refuses connections for subversive activities such as my wife's embroidery sites and slows things down to a snail's pace. Welcome to Dubai. You guys have no idea how good you have it. Thank you, Simon.
That would really needle you, wouldn't it, if you can get the embroidery?
No. You were waiting for that, weren't you? You were so waiting for that. You built that one up. Anyway, thank you very much to everyone for your comments and your concerns. And if anyone else feels compelled to say something, please feel free to do so at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games/digital-content/technology.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we go beyond the hoax and discuss science, culture and philosophy with Alan Sokal, the controversial physicist at the centre of a scandal that rocked the scientific world a decade ago. Also in the show, we hear from the forensics expert who's investigating the conditions necessary for human heads to roll down hills. Whatever turns you on, I suppose. Plus, we'll be investigating whether doctors are right in claiming that the G-spot really does exist. It's all on the new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
That thrusting really reminds me of raw sex on French and Saunders. Do you remember that?
That's the 12-inch mix of the Science Weekly. You know, and it's not many people realise that it's Alok playing the bongos there while he reads it out.
Mm, he's multi-talented.
So, Charles, what's in store for the paper this week?
Well, I'm afraid we don't have the G-spot, but we do have the iBus, which is the new set of London buses that are coming our way, which will all be GPS-enabled and have windows on board. So you can make up our own songs about the windows on the bus and what they do. We've got a piece about the Human Genome Project, which is possibly the largest Linux project going on, apart from Google, maybe. An interview with Mitchell Baker of Mozilla. I review the Neuros OSD video recorder and player. No moving parts, and it's quite amazing. We have a reader who writes about his experiences when he went on the web to find people to help him get rid of some malware. Andrew Brown in the commentary looks at blog commenters and how you get better ones. Vic looks at social entrepreneurs, and Mike Cross will be writing about e-government.
Yes, that is you, Vic. Well, you can check out more on these on Thursday in the technology section. But that's it for this week. We'll be back before you know it. Next week, we'll be talking about robots and what they know about us, which is very exciting. And also look forward to Bobby Johnson. We'll be back.
From rehab. He kicked the habit.
They've let him out for good behavior.
Yeah.
But before then, if you want to contribute to the debate, please do feel free to drop us a line. The address is tech@guardian.co.uk. That's tech, T-E-C-H, @guardian.co.uk. Okay. Thank you very much, Vic, for stepping up to the mic. And as always, to Jemima and Charles and our producer, Scott, over there in the booth. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we shall see you or hear you or whatever next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.